Session number 4816, Reel 2.
Commander Moran, Reel 2.
It was about this time, because we still thought we were off the north coast of Ireland, it was about this time that we saw a ship. And it was dusk. It was a fishing vessel. And the weather was very, very rough at the time. Not a North Atlantic gale, but nevertheless very rough weather. And we approached this ship and called out, and the chaps came out on deck, and it was a French trawler. And I don't think any of us realised at the time, or thought at the time, what the hell's a French trawler doing off the north coast of Ireland. And we asked them if they could let us have some food and water, and they said yes. And they said, one of your officers can come aboard. So, as I spoke French, I went aboard with Mitch to have a chat with them. And the skipper took us along to his cabin and said, well, look, I can pick you people up, but we're not alone here. We're not allowed to go out fishing unless we're supervised. So as soon as I would land you on the French coast, I forget what his port was, but you'd immediately be handed over to the German authorities. And we said, no, to hell with that. And we asked him where we were. And he said, you're somewhere about 60 miles off whatever the port was. It was some port in the north of the Bay of Biscay. And so we said, well, to hell with that. Now we know where we are. We'll get the hell out of it. So they gave us some water and also lowered down to the lifeboat a couple of buckets full of boiled fish. Well, this was the first we'd had to eat since leaving the Mor Vernon, which was then, I suppose, 15 or 16 days, somewhere about that, and we had water in the boat, and we pushed off from there, because under no circumstances, we had one or two chaps who said, well, for Christ's sake, now we've got a ship here, let's take advantage of it. But no, we discussed it and thought, no, to hell with that, and of course this had sobered us up, you know, this meeting up with a real solid ship. This had because we'd got to the stage, quite frankly, when, at least I know I had, and I obviously wasn't alone, I couldn't have been alone in that, when you just couldn't envisage that there was anywhere such a thing as good, solid, dry land, and such thing as an endless supply of water, so that you could just drink and drink and drink, because this was the crying need. And having lost a couple of chaps, and they both died the same way, they'd been begging for water, and there was me sitting on this bloody water container, and we'd gradually reduced the ration, and we got to the stage before the water ran out. It had run out a few days before, when it was half a BOT beaker of water per person per day, which is, well, perhaps two tablespoonfuls of water. This was it. This was all we had, until the water ran out. And One of the chaps, he was a leading seaman, I've forgotten his name, had a bottle of Galloway's. You know, whenever I see the name Galloway's lung syrup nowadays, it takes me right back there. He had this bottle of Galloway's in his overcoat pocket, his bridge coat pocket, or his duffel coat, or whatever he was wearing. And we used to, in turns around the boat, put our finger to the top of the bottle, turn it over so that you got a dab of cough syrup, and put it on your tongue, and that was an absolutely immense relief. And another chap came up with the idea, because you just couldn't get any saliva in your mouth. You know, everything was bone dry, and you know, our lips were swollen, faces looking bloody awful, and we used to suck buttons trying to create saliva. And somebody else mentioned seaweed, and we came across a batch of seaweed one day with the type of seaweed with these big bubbles in it. You know the type, you know, masses of big bubbles. And the belief was that these bubbles were full of liquid, and that you could quench your thirst with that. But all these bubbles were empty. There were just air inside. There was nothing in them whatsoever. So water was the... It was food food, well, I don't think we gave a thought to food. It was just water, just the thought of something to drink. This was the important thing.
What was the weather like?
It was very varied indeed. I only remember the bad weather, and I suppose we must have had some calm weather in between. When we left the Malvernian, the weather was fairly reasonable. The seas were fairly calm. And as I remember, the skies were fairly clear. This was in March. The skies were fairly clear, but we had some bloody awful weather when the waves were just washing inboard, and we spent all our time bailing. We had a square of canvas in the bows, which we tried to rig up, and the chaps took it in turn to shelter under this, and you got quite a degree of shelter from the seas that were washing inboard and from the winds. But my recollection of the weather is it was almost solidly pretty bad. And one or two occasions it was absolutely foul weather, you know, with big seas. But no, this is not just a recollection after a hell of a long time. But I'm convinced that by and large the weather was bloody lousy.
Were you able to collect rainwater?
No, well, we did on one occasion, yes, we did. But it was just on one occasion when we got a heavy downpour of rain. But that water was, because the sail in which we collected it was absolutely impregnated with salt. You know, when the seas washed over the sail and the water evaporated, the salt didn't evaporate, you see, so that the sails were absolutely impregnated with salt, and this water was salty. But nevertheless, we did on one occasion collect some water, but it wasn't much. I can almost see it now, the water we collected, I don't know, maybe a gallon, I don't know. But as I see it now, that sort of pool of water in the sail, it couldn't have been much more than a gallon. But it was water that was this was in our thoughts, and I can still see some of the chaps who had been, well, I say some, but two in particular, I remember, who'd been drinking the bilge water in the bottom of the boat, and just wouldn't pay any attention whatsoever. And they both died. One of them had pushed over the side on one occasion. He was pulled back and just said, "I'm off." Over the side he went, and he was grabbed and pulled aboard. But I suppose we're all round the bloody bend. I had a phone call a couple of weeks ago from Johnny Wells, who was in the lifeboat with me, and I hadn't met him. He was a midshipman at the time. I hadn't met him until since I left Marlegg, which was early in 1942 when I left Marlegg. I hadn't met him since then, and he phoned me a few weeks ago, which was a very, very pleasant surprise, and I had a letter from him yesterday. He was Lord Mayor of Westminster a few years ago, and he's now, and I assume that he had connections with the Red Cross before, he's now part of a think tank in London, whose job is to conjure up ideas to raise money for the Red Cross, and he'd put forward certain ideas and asked me if I'd cooperate, and in fact I posted a letter back to him yesterday saying, well, of course I'll cooperate as fully as I can, you know, and I'm talking, I think, for all the ex-Coldest chaps, we're in it with you. What he has in mind, amongst other things, is when the next POW reunions come along, I don't know how many of them there are, but as they come along, there'll be a concerted effort to devote these reunions to fundraising for the Red Cross.
Because of the role that the Red Cross played for POW?
Oh, well, absolutely, because without the Red Cross, well, Christ, there are a hell of a lot of us who wouldn't be here now. They were our lifeline during the war. But to get back to the lifeboat, Things were obviously vastly improved because we'd had something to eat, and we'd got some water on board. And according to the notes I made later, when I was a POW, it was on the 21st day in the lifeboat that we spotted an aircraft, and we were sure we had a rough idea where we were, but we just couldn't account for drift in a lifeboat. I don't know what sort of a nautical chap you are, but okay, in a lifeboat which has got nothing to grip the water. I mean, there it is, you see, as opposed to a yacht, which has got that, but underneath it's got its keel, you see, and it's only the keel that will grip the water. It's only with a keel that you can cut through the seas. If the seas are trying to push you that way, and your keel is going that way, the keel will cut through. But if you haven't got a keel, as with a lifeboat, well, if the seas and the winds want to push you that way, there's nothing you can do to stop them. They'll push you that way, you see. So that we just didn't know what the drift was. And we spotted this aircraft. We were too high up to identify. We had a piece of broken mirror in the boat, and we flashed that, and I can see us now standing up in the boat. I can see myself hanging onto the mast and waving, and the aircraft circled around and pushed off. And then the next day we spotted some smoke on the horizon, and of course everyone was mad with excitement. About, I think, 25 or 26 of us left then. We lost 5 in all in the boats. Yes, there must have been 25 left then. And we, as I say, absolutely mad with excitement. The ship got nearer. We could see it was a battle wagon of one sort or another. And it was a peculiar sort of battleship grey, and we were arguing which of our fleets it belonged to, whether it's from the Atlantic fleet or the West Indies fleet or the Mediterranean fleet or the home fleet, which one is it? And it got nearer still, and there was a bloody great swastika flying from the stern. So it settled all those arguments. What was wonderful seeing the ship, but what disturbed us was, as it got a bit closer, the whole rail was lined with steel-helmeted German sailors, each with a rifle pointed at the boat, and we thought, Christ almighty, what the hell's going to happen now? Because we'd read the propaganda, or it might not have been propaganda, but we'd read in the papers about survivors being shot by the Germans, so we didn't know what the hell was going to happen. But the ship drew alongside the boat. They'd lowered the companionway, and a couple of German seamen went down to the bottom of the companionway, pulled the boat alongside, and they carried all of us. None of us could stand on our feet. They carried all of us aboard, and we learned later that as soon as the lifeboat had been reported by the aircraft, as soon as the captain of the ship, a German destroyer, had spotted the boat, he'd signalled down to the galley to prepare hot soup, phoned down to the wardroom and to the mess decks to prepare to look after survivors. And they were really good. We were taken down to the wardroom where they'd laid mattresses on the deck and came along with bowls of hot soup and something to drink, some whatever it was, schnapps or whiskey or whatever it was, cigarettes, everything there. No attempt to question us. It was a sort of the sort of reception that you'd expect to get as a shipwrecked seaman. They made us very, very comfortable indeed. But while we were there, he had the radio on. We suddenly caught a name, Lady Summers, and we pricked up our ears, because a Lady Summers was also an ocean boarding vessel. And on our last stay at the tail of the bank, and we used to put in, our patrols lasted about a month, I suppose, and we used to put in once a month or whenever it was back to the tail of the bank for fuel and victuals. and the Lady Summers was in at the same time, and we were invited aboard, and we spent an evening there, knocking back their booze and having a damn good time. And this was the Lady Summers who reported on the German radio that she'd been sunk. Whether there are any survivors from her or not, I don't know. I never did find out. Anyhow, the next day we were landed at La Palice in the Bay of Biscay, which was a German base then, and put into a sick bay there. Well, what went by the name of a sick bay? It was a hut with some beds, iron beds. The chap in charge was he was a German in the German Navy. I forget what his rank was. He might have been, I think he was commissioned rank, commissioned warrant officer or whatever the German equivalent was. But his first greeting to us was that he'd been a prisoner of war in Australia in the last war, and he'd had a bloody lousy time of it, and he didn't see any reason why we shouldn't have a bloody lousy time of it. Well, it wasn't as bad as that. Our big grumble was that we couldn't get any treatment for the wounded chaps. We still had Petty Officer King, who really was in pain. I mean, you can imagine with a chunk shot out of your backside, sitting in a lifeboat for 21 days with the seas washing over the boat. Poor old Cox and King must have had a hell of a bloody time. We had another chap, a leading seaman, a chap who had a wound in his foot, and he was in a pretty bad way. But we got no real medical treatment there. We were kept there until we could stand on our feet. And then we were entrained for Germany. I think that journey took about 3 days. It was pretty dreary, that journey, but we were lucky. I suppose we had one chap, one of the Feldpolizei, military police. They carry a badge of rank, a bloody great chain around their necks, you know, a wide chain with a medallion there. This is their badge of office. And very important people. This was a very reasonable chap, because going up through France, and we went up through France through Paris and up through Tyr, up to Wilhelmshaven, and the train stopped at various stations. I don't know who else was on the train. Were there any other prisoners on there? I just don't know. I don't think so. I think we were the only prisoners, and we were pretty well guarded. In any case, we weren't in the right, I suppose, mental mood to try to do anything about it, or to give a thought to doing anything about it, because there were plenty of guards around there to look after us. But on the stations, on the French stations, lurking in the corners, well, the kids there, they must have been used to this, because there were kids there, little girls and boys, and looking up and down the platform, and if the coast was clear, they come tearing along, push something through the window. It might be a bottle of wine or some fruit or whatever it was. And I remember on one occasion when policeman chap, the Feldpolizei chap, spotted a couple of youngsters, and they saw him look at them. They went tearing away, and they were stopped. And he said, "Well, fine, okay, you can go along and give this to the prisoners," which they did. Yes, I always remember that chap.
These were French children?
These were French kids, yes. I was looking back, one of the regrets one has, you know, it's so easy looking back and saying, well, I should have done this and I should have done that. One of the regrets one had was not perhaps taking more opportunity of that particular journey. What we could have done, I don't know. I'd say it's easy to look back and say, well, now if I could do that trip all over again, I'd have done this and I'd have done that. You know, I think most of us in our lives indulge in that sort of thinking. Anyhow, from there we were taken up to Wilhelmshaven, which is the interrogation centre prisoners of war, and there we were. We were all locked up together in a room, and I don't think this was too bad. It was one room and had no... Yes, it did. It had one window to it, which was very, very heavily barred, and there was a sentry on the street outside walking up and down. And we used to... I don't think the food was too bad. I know we used to get a bloody great thick stew at midday. You're full of all sorts of things. After the first couple of days, we realised that that's all we were going to get, although, you know, it was adequate, but we weren't going to get any more, so... We used to pick out perhaps half of the solids there and keep them to one side, save them for the evening. A couple of things I remember so clearly about that. We had an exercise period, I think two a day, in a little walled garden at the back where we could walk around. We'd had nothing to smoke. And of course, we were dying for a smoke. I think perhaps one of the biggest temptations of our lives was walking around there, and you'd see down there a bloody great long cigarette butt, you know, a cigarette that had been half smoked, and the temptation was to grab the damn thing. And somebody else was, or some other thing was digging you in inside and said, "Christ, no, don't do that. Don't let yourself down. You can do without a cigarette." And you had that tussle there. You were longing to get that bloody cigarette. But there was one of the guards there on the door who was pretty good, and occasionally he'd slip through some tobacco and cigarette papers and matches so that we were able to have a smoke. I remember before that, Mitch said, "Well, you know, try anything once," and we had some old string in there and newspaper, and we tried rolling that up in newspaper and lighting it, but of course that was just impossible. Now this, you know, it really bloody well annoys me now. Okay, I understand people who don't smoke. Good luck to them. God bless them. But when I think of all the constraints now that are being put on smokers, I often think back on those days when it was accepted that one of the major comforts for the troops and for prisoners of war, one of the major comforts, if not the first consideration, was let's get some smokes to them, let's get some cigarettes to them. You see? And this all seems to be forgotten now. And what the country is saying now to people of my age, to whom cigarettes were so very, very important, is saying, "You're a naughty boy now for smoking. You should stop smoking." This bloody well angers me. Why the bloody hell should I stop smoking? That's by the way.
You said this was an interrogation centre.
Yes. Yeah.
How did they conduct the interrogation?
Oh, they were very reasonable indeed, as I remember it. I don't remember being pushed on anything. They asked us the normal questions. We had cards to fill in, you know, name, rank, number, because we don't have numbers in the Navy, at least the officers don't. Next of kin, name and address of next of kin, and other details they insisted on, and one learnt later on how important they were to the Germans in their POW security approach. Mother's maiden name, where one's mother was born, and various things like that. These are used later on. You know, I came up against this later on. I mean, for example, a few years later when I swapped identities with, and we'll come to that later, I swapped identities with a soldier and went out on a working party, and when we were re-caught, all these questions were asked. You know, they had a background of family details, and they threw these questions at you, saying this was part and parcel of it. But I think we're about 3 weeks at Wilhelmshaven. Somewhere about 3 weeks at Wilhelmshaven, and I said I don't think it was too bad there. You seem to have survived it, and then we were sent on to Marlab. Which was the naval POW camp, which wasn't far away. It's Marlag up in the middle of the marshes in northwest Germany, approximately halfway between Hamburg and Bremen. That was a typical POW camp, hutted camp with barbed wire all around it. In fact, two barbed wire fences, each about 14, 15 feet high, I suppose, and coiled barbed wire in between these two fences, and inside an anti-tunneling ditch, which was perhaps 12 feet wide and 6 or 7 feet deep, perhaps something like that, and that went all around inside the perimeter of the compound. Of course, this was like a home from home when we arrived at Marlag, because there were a hell of a lot of naval and merchant service prisoners there, because at that time it was Marlag and Milag Nor, in other words, combined Navy and merchant service POW camp. We were separated a little later, but at that time it was a combined camp, and we were met at the gates when we came into the compound. We were met by Sam Stewart.
By whom?
Sam Stewart. He was the I think they called him the man of confidence. The SBO was Captain what the hell was his name was? I can't think of his name offhand, but Sam Stewart, who was a lieutenant RN, was the man of confidence. He was the sort of contact man with the Germans, a welfare officer. You might call him the welfare officer inside. Yes. And he was there with a couple of others waiting at the entrance of the compound to greet us when we came in. They'd been told, presumably, that we were arriving, and led us along to one of the huts where they'd made a pot of tea and gave us cartons of cigarettes and produced packets of biscuits. And we thought, oh my God, what have we come to here? And that very evening there was a concert, and they had an awful lot of gifted people there. In fact, one ship that was sunk, either the Van Dyke or the Voltaire, they'd been liners, passenger liners before the war, and they had large crews, and they still had on board the people who'd been members of the ship's band before the war, when she was in commercial use. And they got up shows, and you had an awful lot of pretty gifted people there. They got up shows. Now, first evening there was in one of the huts had been turned into a theatre with proper stage and lighting and everything to go with it. And we had the show there, which we thought was fine. We thought, oh God, you know, we've fallen on our feet here. And of course, our first day or so, chaps were flooding us with all sorts of things. No, you short of this, you short of that. There were clothes, because we were pretty ragged, as you can imagine, when we arrived there. And we were issued with new battle dress, British Army battle dress, which the Germans had captured, and boots, and no, not boots, clogs, yes, the clogs, yes, there were no boots, clogs with wooden soles. And I think for a couple of weeks we settled down. We settled down quite well there, but I'd been brought up on, I suppose you might call it, a spirit of adventure. My father had run away from home when he was 13, I think, and went to sea. He went to sea in Sale. He eventually got his master mariner's ticket in Sale. Eventually, before the beginning of the First World War, joined the RNAS from the Royal Canadian Navy. He became a flyer, and he was part and parcel of the opening up of the air routes to the Near East and the Middle East and so on after the First World War. And I used to devour every adventure book I got hold of. And you know, things like the tunnels of Holzminden. And as a boy, I used to think, oh, my God, you know, weren't these chaps lucky to have these adventures? And then I found myself in that situation. And I clued up with a chap called Johnny Crisp, who was a bosun RN at the time. And we got very, very pally, and we used to walk round and round. Well, I clued up with him first of all because he was a keep fit expert, apart from his naval qualifications as a bosun. A bosun RN is that rank no longer exists, and it was a commissioned warrant officer. In other words, same as a warrant officer in the army, and sort of in the middle between non-commissioned and commissioned ranks. He'd retired from the Navy at the same time as I did, as a two and a halfer. But old Johnny Crisp induced me to join his keep fit class, and this meant getting up before the others in the morning and trotting around the compound and having a cold dip. And the cold dip was even in the winter, and there's a bloody great big barrel of water under the gutterings, and it meant breaking the ice and jumping quickly in and out of that. So he and I clued up together.